Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, September 24th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson.
You're at the UN. You're a world leader. You're at the UN. You take your rightful place within the General Assembly. You sit down and you hear these words: your countries are going to hell. That is what happened yesterday as Trump aired his grievances at the UN. And it was a, as the New York Times puts it, a meandering address, which I think is, while I think in journalism school they would have said that we were editorializing, although it does seem factual to say that it was a somewhat meandering address.
And four times his allotted time, yeah. Right?
Yes.
I thought meandering was polite.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
A polite description of what
generous.
It.
Yeah.
But again, yeah, Bill, well, right? In journalism,
I
you
think
would
meandering
say,
is the right word.
Yeah, we would say there was, it was, you know, I think if I had written that in school, they'd probably say, oh, you know, you're editorializing. But then when you watch it, you think, oh, well, that's meandering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I watched a lot of it. I admit I didn't watch all 56 minutes of it.
Yeah.
But he seemed to be reading from prepared text, the part I saw.
Yeah.
And so if it was meandering, it was meandering on purpose. Like he was, that would, they planned that. They wrote him 56 minutes worth of text. Maybe I was misinterpreting, but he was looking down at papers on the on the lectern, and
yeah,
so it looked to me like he was reading it. So.
Well, there were some prompter errors. He was having problems with the prompter, and then the escalator going up. Which, if you haven't seen that video, that's worth the price of admission. But once he started talking, he accused environmentalists of wanting to kill all the cows. Mm-hmm. He personally insulted the Muslim mayor of London. He bashed allies and foes across the globe. He questioned whether the United Nations should even exist. Mm. What is the purpose of the United Nations? President Trump asked a gathering at the UN General Assembly on Tuesday in a meandering 56-minute speech that extended nearly four times as long as his allotted time limit, as Sarah noted a moment ago. I'm really good at this stuff, Mr. Trump said. Your countries are going to hell.
Okay.
In his remarks, Mr. Trump lectured the United Nations and other countries about how they were failing and aired a list of grievances. Those included, but were not limited to, a malfunctioning escalator at the UN, his not winning a renovation contract at the UN during the time as a real estate developer, windmills, always windmills, other countries' immigration policies, which he claimed were leading them to ruin, and the way Brazil is being run. Soon after the speech, Mr. Trump made news in another forum. In a social media post, he made a stunning pivot on Ukraine, saying that the country, with the support of Europe, was in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form. Remember when they didn't have any cards?
They were cardless.
They got some, apparently. But anyway, so his declaration of welcome development to European allies was made shortly after a meeting in New York with President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. But what appeared to be a major foreign policy shift in the afternoon came only after a lengthy morning lecture by the American president. The White House had billed Mr. Trump's address to the 80th session of the UN General Assembly as a chance for the president to lay out his vision for how America should wield its power abroad. Bill Hammond.
My mother watched this, and her reaction was to remember when she was younger and seeing film of like a third world military dictator getting up and kind of breastfeeding, you know, like, you're not going to take me down. And that like, so this tone of speech is not unheard of at a place like the UN. They do have people kind of mouth off. The difference is that it's coming from, you know, possibly the single most powerful leader in the world, single most powerful country in the world. And the country that traditionally has been trying to show leadership of the world. And the frustration, part of the frustration with the UN is that they don't always accept our agenda. In fact, they often completely disagree with our agenda, especially with Trump's agenda. And the thing that strikes me, and maybe I should review the text, the 56 minutes of text, but I didn't hear him ask for anything. I didn't hear him, like, here is where I want to take the world. He didn't show a path. If you're leading the world, you want to say, this is where we're going. This is my plan for improving the world. I heard a lot of complaints. I heard a lot of kind of insults being thrown, insults or criticisms, if you want to be more kind about it. And some of them I thought were legitimate. Some of them were cranky. The line about going, you know, the escalator and the teleprompter, actually, he said that very early in the speech, and it was a little cranky on his part. But that's the one point where he got a laugh.
Yeah.
Like, the audience was with him on that. This facility is crappy. And they, like, the teleprompters don't work and the escalators don't work. And all the diplomats in the room could agree with him on that. But a lot of the rest of it, they were sitting very stone-faced. I think they've come to understand that he is a mercurial character, as we often say. It's kind of like saying a speech is meandering. And so they knew, look, we're just going to let him blow off steam, and then we'll have side meetings and we might get something we want out of them. And that's actually what happened, especially for Ukraine.
Sarah.
Yeah. And anybody who's been to the UN buildings can see that they're not, you know, state-of-the-art facilities necessarily. But in part, that's because President Trump has taken $1 billion of funding from the United Nations and has promised to take another $1 billion soon. And the United Nations budget largely comes from the United States because we are supposed to be a leader on the national stage. So he wasn't there to ask for anything. He was there to let everyone know where he stands, what his plans are, what his bluster is, delegitimize the institution. I'm curious about what sort of institutions might take the place of all of these institutions that he's belittling and making a mockery of. Maybe he doesn't believe that we need institutions at all, period. Maybe I'm assuming that he puts more thought into his comments than he really does, but you know, he does this stuff in order to get a lot of attention focused on some of this, like, really wild stuff that he said. I mean, you mentioned some of them, but there's more stuff about the, you know, the climate change made by stupid people as the greatest con job ever. Something about cows.
There's 56 minutes of stuff.
Yeah, persecuted Christians, which, like, is a thing. I've represented persecuted Christians in asylum claims from different parts of the country, but you know, and I think he does that because it takes attention away from what's actually happening in the back rooms around really the control that the United States has over the functioning of the United Nations, which is a bureaucracy which could use some probably tuning up, but not a bull in a china shop.
I just want to say one quick thing. The last time I was at the UN was after they had done a renovation of the UN. And so, yes, it has its creaks, but there are also has been some tremendous work done. And it is, I think, if you have gone into it and walked through the halls, a gorgeous facility.
which is a little fact
check
here.
Well, I didn't go there since fifth grade, so I...
Right, a little fact check here. The elevator situation turns out to be his videographer tripped the emergency stop button. So that's why the elevator stopped. And the...
It did look like, though, that somebody had just shut it down the minute he stepped on it.
Because his videographer tripped
the... It was
the,
very funny.
His reportedly, his... This is what I read. I wasn't there. I don't know. But reportedly, his videographer, one of his videographers, tripped the emergency stop button.
I apologize for interrupting. I just want to quickly say that, again, and because this is news, I'm not... the only reason I'm doing this is because this is news. But in Jimmy Kimmel's monologue last night, he said, if only the gold escalator 10 years ago didn't work, we wouldn't be in this movie.
I thought that was very, very timely. And the other thing about the teleprompter is I read that... they have it set up so each person has their own people handling their their mechanics. And so whatever went wrong with the teleprompter wasn't a UN person. It was there. But I was interested, Sarah, if you don't mind me asking, that the chunk of it about immigration, basically demanding them all to stop taking immigrants because it's ruining their country. Did you hear that?
Yep. Well, and another part that's really disturbing is the bit about the United States withdrawing from the Human Rights Convention, which is the bedrock of asylum law and a lot of other protections for the most vulnerable people, including persecuted Christians.
Bob, let's go to your comments, and then I would like to really dig into the immigration issue.
Okay. Making Friends and Influencing Enemies was sort of the title of yesterday's event. And Sarah, I thought your points were really spot on. And Teresa, regardless of how the escalator shut off or the teleprompter shut off, I just found it really ironic that we still, as a country, owe billions of dollars to this organization, which we had committed to. So I was sort of chalking it up to if we had just paid our bills, those devices would have continued. You know, imagine sitting there right now and thinking about the tariffs, thinking about how in the course of an 8-month period, every single one of those other countries' economies have been negatively impacted by the policies of this person. Think about just sitting there. And Joe, who doesn't love being lectured by a self-indulgent narcissist? I mean, it had to have been just special. And I actually did hear
him. I don't know what that's like, Bob.
Let me see if I can relive the experience for you. He did ask for things, though. He again made a pitch for recognition for his peace efforts.
He wants
a Nobel Peace Prize. He let everybody in that room know that he's very upset because he's not being lauded for all of his accomplishments. He put a real stake into the issue of climate, which he called the greatest con job. I would argue that this presidency far exceeds that as the biggest con job. I love the fact that, you know, we talk about a 15-minute time slot. And I understand you run over for a couple of minutes, but to run over as much as he did was just insulting to everybody else. And if you haven't seen the video, Joe, the French president's motorcade.
Oh, it's great.
Was stopped on the streets of New York City in order for Trump to blow through. So
he called him from the side of the road.
Yeah. The answer to the climate change is clean, beautiful coal.
Yep.
Which I thought was
so clean, beautiful.
Was interesting. The fixation and fascination with Brazil continues to both perplex me. If you haven't seen today, because of tariffs, the price of coffee, most of which comes from Brazil, is up 21%. And talk about killing cows, the amount of beef that we get from Brazil is also part of the reason that the cost of our food is up. He also made a comment about blowing out of existence. I thought that was an interesting use of words, which I take as a direct threat that there's an unchecked willingness to use force, whether it's legal or illegal. And I think there's still some significant questions, both domestically but internationally, about our use of force that raises some enormous questions.
I have no idea about this, although I can mm-hmm. I think probably you all will agree with me. But the minute I heard that line, I thought, oh, Stephen Miller is once again crafting this, yeah. Which I think goes to Bill's very good point about how this is scripted. I mean, this is not off the top of your head.
But I'm not sure it was scripted. I think I don't know if you can ever script. And I didn't see his finger moving on the page, so I wasn't sure he was reading or not. It doesn't, you know, he was looking down. I think he wanders, and I will continue to feel in my heart of hearts that we're watching a man in significant cognitive decline, and I say that with similar criticism of to Biden, but I will note that if Biden had made that speech, they would be melting down. The right would be melting down right now. End of the day, besides all of the jokes and snarky comments, we as a country lost face in yesterday's session. The winners in my mind are China and the European Union, who are going to continue to move away from our from partnerships and alliances with us. I think there's a general hope that this is a fleeting change, but it's also a recognition that dependence on the United States, dependence on the United States government, on the wisdom of the American people, on things like the dollar as the financial marker, are threats to the overall global security, which is going to lead to a reshuffling of the world order at the expense of this country.
That was Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 24th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 25th, Joe was joined by Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, a grants analyst based in Albany, Emily Honan, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Her research is on health, wellness, and medical knowledge, Catherine Tan.
President Trump's decision this week to abruptly cancel a meeting with top Democrats aimed at averting a government shutdown within days highlighted the toxic relationship helping drive Congress and the White House toward a crisis. With a Republican governing trifecta, Mr. Trump has adopted a go-it-alone approach at the dawn of a second term, freezing out Democrats and never once inviting their leaders to the White House for negotiations or anything else. With Democrats opposing him at every turn, the president has been able to rely exclusively on Republicans to push through his big priorities, including enacting a major tax cut and domestic policy bill, clawing back billions in congressionally approved spending, and winning confirmation of his nominees. That will not be the case when it comes to funding the government, which Congress must do by Tuesday to avoid a shutdown. Because Republicans have only a narrow majority in the Senate, passing a government spending bill that can win the necessary 60 votes depends on attracting at least a small amount of Democratic support. That will require bipartisan negotiation, an art that has been fading steadily on Capitol Hill and so far has been lost altogether during the second term of Mr. Trump. Even talks around whether and when to meet have prompted a round of recriminations and finger-pointing. Mr. Trump said earlier this month that Republicans should not even bother negotiating with Democrats and suggested his party could fund the government solely with Republican votes. The characterization infuriated Democrats who have demanded that any measure to extend spending also carry more than $1 trillion to continue Obamacare subsidies and reverse cuts to Medicaid and other health programs that Republicans made over the summer. Mr. Trump canceled the meeting after a call with Speaker Mike Johnson and Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the majority leader, who urged the president not to meet with Democratic leaders. Mr. Johnson has told reporters before the meeting was canceled that he was not certain it was necessary. So, how do you negotiate, Nick Rangel, if you're not meeting with the people that you need to negotiate with?
To be fair, it's the staff behind the scenes doing the vast majority of the negotiations at the tables. I think the public conversations between leaders, there's a strategy that makes it appear that they're not talking behind the scenes, but also there's some sense that the Republican leadership are sort of afraid that the president will back them into the corner on things and get out ahead of the Republican leadership in Congress. And so I think they're trying to contain any potential slip-ups that the president might make in that kind of meeting. That's not to say that staff aren't working on language at the tables, not in public. I think what's kind of more interesting is that the House went on recess after passing the continuing resolution, which makes it actually more difficult to get the members in front of legislation to review that language and provide feedback to the staff. So the recess itself, I think, is actually the bigger delay.
So what do you think will happen?
Oh, I think we're going to have a shutdown. I mean, I don't think this party is afraid of a shutdown. I don't think Donald Trump is afraid of a shutdown. I think they are very confident that their messaging will be able to both avoid a confrontational response to the shutdown and that they'll be able to continue to sort of flood the zone with these other sort of circus shows going on.
Yeah, Emily. I definitely agree with the sort of like distraction tactic. And I also think it's very transparent what they're trying to do with getting Trump out of the room with Democrats because they're afraid he's just going to change his mind or say something crazy and then they'll have a whole new thing to worry about. I think they're much more like, no, let us do this behind the scenes. And unfortunately, I feel like the Democrats are put in a pretty difficult situation because passing the continuing resolution is also not very popular. I mean, they try to frame it in a way that's like, oh, we're preventing this shutdown, we're doing good, but also it's defunding a lot of programs that people really need. I mean, I remember when the last continuing resolution was passed, that was I wouldn't say catastrophic, but it was very, very stressful for a lot of the communities that I work with that were depending on earmarks for things like, and I mean, these are not necessarily Democratic communities, I would say. I mean, these are people who probably voted for this, and now they don't get water and don't get sewer because of all this just like infighting. And I think it really speaks to the human element of the whole problem.
Catherine?
I think Democrats don't really have much of a choice but to kind of hold strong here, because this is an opportunity to backtrack the many things that are getting cut because of the big, beautiful bill. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering is, like, if we do have, and this is a question that's probably better answered by the two of you, if we do have a government shutdown, I mean, oftentimes when that happens, fingers are pointed at, like, the president. So Trump, being someone who likes to deflect blame and to dodge any sort of criticism that comes his way, how do you see him handling this? Because if you see a shutdown as being perhaps almost inevitable, like, yeah, how I'm just curious, like, you know, he's not meeting with Democrats to talk through the bills, like, so how do you anticipate him managing?
I think it's a bygone conclusion that the Democrats will be blamed and no one will question it, because the facts don't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. In this administration, they never really have. I mean, he can just say, directly say, I wanted to meet with the Democrats, but they refused. And people will believe that, even if you throw the truth in his face. So that's why I think the Democrats are in a pretty bad situation, which, like, no matter what they do, they're going to be blamed, and people are going to believe that, unfortunately.
Right. So even if there are compromises, then their own party is going to say, well, why would you do that, right? Yeah, like, this was an opportunity to save some of the things that were lost. And if they hold steady, then...
A point that was made on yesterday's program, unless you think I don't listen to what you actually say, that was that you have a Republican Congress, you have a Republican Senate, and you have a Republican president, and you're going to blame the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. They will, and they'll get away with it.
Well, I have concocted a roadmap that has no chance in hell of ever happening. But I think that Trump... Again, I'm not an idiot. I know this is not going to happen, but bear with me. Trump has been shamelessly campaigning to get a Nobel Peace Prize because he's allegedly solved 7 wars. Well, he should be turning inward and looking at this country and seeing how divided it is, in large part but not entirely, of his own making. And the roadmap is that he's going to come into the Oval Office and he's going to command the network attention. And he's going to say, a new day has dawned in this country. I'm not going to call people names anymore. I'm not going to refuse to meet people anymore who I should be meeting with for a bipartisan solution to this and other problems. And I'm calling in the leadership of the House and the Senate, and we're going to get together and we're going to solve this. And sure, it's not going to be easy. We do have legitimate policy differences. But I want to eliminate all the auxiliary crap that is muddying the waters. And by the way, if we're successful in this initiative and we get ourselves a budget and avoid a shutdown, or at least minimize the amount of time a shutdown entails, let's try this with all various other issues that we have facing us. And then I'll nominate myself for a Nobel Peace Prize because I brought peace to America.
And then Tiny Tim sits on his lap and says, God bless him, everyone.
I haven't had anything to drink yet this morning other than water.
Interesting letter from Deborah as we talk about the shutdown crisis and the possibility of a shutdown coming October 1st, which will be this coming Tuesday. Deborah writes, the government is already partially shut down. Look at the cutbacks, the firings, the aid withdrawals. I don't have to rehash it. A typical tactic trying to stoke fear. Democrats need to stand tall and, quote unquote, claw back health care. It's an interesting point that there is so much of government that has been eliminated, gutted, stopped, not funded.
Nick was discussing how this would be difficult for nonprofits, and it's like, well, it already kind of has been. Some have already been completely defunded.
Oh, we're in that. Yeah. Including us.
I feel like you know about that.
Yes, I know something about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a federal shutdown would have kind of various impacts on a on some agencies. Non-emergency funding would stop or pause for that period of time. Emergency funding would generally continue. Organizations that are already funded would continue to get the money that they've already distributed or awarded. So for our organization, Legal Aid Society, the LSC organization, which is funded by Congress but is a separate nonprofit, it has its money already and will be able to continue to make payments on our grant for 3 months. The longest shutdown was in 2018 under the previous Trump administration. That was 35 days. So, you know, the analysts are thinking, sure, there may be a shutdown. We've seen shutdowns many times in the last couple of decades. It's almost routine, which is really sad to consider. But, you know, worst case scenario, you can expect something to be adopted or passed before the end of that, like, 3 month sort of soft landing space. What I would know, what I sort of the thought popped in my head is that the Democratic Party is not typically able or like disciplined enough to keep all of its members from making decisions on how to vote independently. Mm-hmm. We know, for example, John Fetterman voted in support of the continuing resolution to keep funding flat. And so I do suspect that marginal members or members who are moderate or kind of lean conservative, even as they identify as Democrats in the caucus, are likely to support some kind of continuing resolution that would actually keep funding flat during that CR period. The continuing resolution that the House passed was what's called a clean CR. It does not change funding levels except that it increases security for certain agencies. So there are some Democrats who think that a CR is not as toxic as the party, I think, is describing it as.
You think the Democrats are doing a good job explaining their position?
No,
that's it. We were talking about this last week when I was here, and I think there was a consensus that the Democrats' message again is muddled, and it needs to find the right message and the right spokespeople to describe the message. Or else they're just gonna wither away, and perhaps they're waiting for Trump to say, okay, we're gonna lay off thousands of more people, and then they'll blame the Republicans, and the Democrats will prevail. But I'm not confident in that, and I'm still of the mind that the Democrats are not explaining to the American people well enough what their position is and why it's the right position.
Yeah, I agree. They can be a lot noisier right now about how Trump is unwilling to meet with them and to reach some kind of resolution, and also amplify that what they're trying to do is like restore cuts to Medicaid, which is so important. It's going to impact like millions of people. And These are important points that need to be, you know, blown up a little bit bigger.
I think the challenge with the messaging around Medicaid is that the majority of the cuts don't happen until 2027, until after midterms. And so it's difficult to tie today's shutdown to a future possibility. Yeah. There would be hypothetically many opportunities before those changes take effect for a Democratic majority to take back the House or the Senate and reverse or pass legislation on its own to, you know, undo those changes, those future changes, or repeal those future changes. And so for people right now, they're not seeing a direct and immediate correlation. There are people who are having a harder time getting Social Security, but it's because of the shift in its spending away from frontline workers towards their 800 phone number and their other sort of tech-centered projects and the closure of offices and new requirements to come and prove your identity in person. And then, identity mistakes in documentation of people's living status, as in people are being designated as deceased. So, those are real, but they're not impacting enough people to change the trajectory of, like, the Democratic messaging.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 25th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, September 26th, Joe was joined by Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Diddis, writer, analyst, recently retired president of Siena University, and former New York Congressman Chris Gibson, and Siena University Professor of Economics Aaron Pacitti.
Former FBI Director James Comey was indicted Thursday on allegations he lied to Congress, a sign of President Donald Trump's growing influence over the Justice Department amid his extraordinary demands it prosecute a man he has long considered a political foe. The indictment issued by federal grand jury in Alexandria charges Comey with one count of making false statements and one count of obstruction of Congress. Charges punishable by up to 5 years in prison. It was delivered over the objections of career prosecutors who insisted there was insufficient evidence to charge Comey with a crime. Separating now from the Washington Post article, Chris Gibson, this was fascinating to me because the president was looking for someone to do this. He had someone he thought could do it. They didn't do it. He fired them. He got somebody new who was very young. I don't use this as a disparaging term, but inexperienced in this particular realm. And there is a statute of limitations that would have gone up, I think, on Tuesday, I believe. So here we are.
Yeah.
What does this mean?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a process here. I think, having just spent the last couple years looking at asymmetry of power, consolidation of power, I'm not shocked by this. I think this is in part what happens when the imperial presidency gets weaponized. But, you know, again, just for the listeners, in terms of the claims here, this has to do with a 2016 investigation of which he was asked about formally in 2020. And the claim is that when he responded to that inquiry, he made a false statement. It's allegedly surrounds a leak to the media. And so we're going to find out whether or not, you know, the statement that he made in 2020 is he had nothing to do with that leak. Cash Patel, when he went in as the FBI director, he claims he found some new files that may shed light on this. Look, you're innocent until proven guilty. It was once said during Watergate, you can, you know, basically indict a ham sandwich. So, so we'll see what happens here in the end. I mean, look, we've seen that in New York State as well. You know, I mean, Steve McLaughlin was indicted. And before a jury of his peers, he was found not guilty. So and Joe Bruno, of course. I mean, so there are examples of this. Now we're at the federal level. So Comey is going to have his day in court. And we'll find out on all of this as to whether or not there is new revelations. But, you know, I'm also interested in is accountability. If he was, in fact, guilty, then he'll be held accountable. But if he is not guilty, then is there any accountability to potentially an overreach with this indictment? History would say no, there won't be. I mean, there certainly wasn't any consequence when all that
taxpayer money was spent on prosecuting McLaughlin and found not guilty. And by the way, that jury returned in like an hour or something like that. So I hope I'm pleasantly surprised that there'll be accountability in one form or another.
Ashley.
Yeah, so this indictment is on 1.5 pieces of paper. It's not a very robust we really don't know yet what their case will be. But there's a lot of things that are outside of Comey that we should be looking at with this. This is Who's Next is another reinvigorated the investigation against our Attorney General Letitia James. Obviously, there's a lot of buzz right now about George Soros and diverting DOJ resources. About half a dozen field offices right now are researching George Soros and his foundation. Adam Schiff, the list goes on and on. And so it looks like the DOJ doesn't work for the American people anymore. They work for Donald Trump. The prosecutor who he installed on Monday, as of last week, her main objective was rooting out negative aspects of slavery from our Smithsonian institutions. Now is this week, within 4 days, bringing charges against one of Donald Trump's biggest political adversaries. His perception, I don't really think that James Comey is as beloved by the left, certainly not after the events of 2016. So it's sort of a curious choice, but he has an obsession with him. And it seems to be that they're placating how he feels more than how the rest of us feel. So this makes us less safe. The DOJ is supposed to be doing lots of work to help the American public be safe. And now we're seeing it taken over by the president, with no check on that. The legislative branch and the courts are also lockstep. So this is a scary thing. It's a constitutional crisis, I think, and it's potentially an impeachable offense, but don't hold your breath and see that happen. And so this is it's really sad. It's really sad to see. And I also, in reading about this, what jumped out to me is that, you know, people that work for the DOJ and the FBI, career prosecutors, career agents, they don't like working there right now. They want to leave. And who's going to replace them but loyalists to the president? And that's just going to make the situation far, far worse going forward.
Aaron Pasitti.
I've got two thoughts on this. One has to do with political theory and the other with psychology. The way Trump governs is what I'm calling the mafia theory of the state, or the Tony Soprano theory of the state, where he rules by intimidation and punishment to show strength. It's largely the politics of vengeance and humiliation against his enemies. He's weaponized the government against any and all opposition. And, you know, the goal here isn't to improve public service or the functioning of American society, get the economy ready, you know, for 21st century manufacturing, but the goal seems to be to, you know, bolster his, as Chris said, imperial presidency by instilling fear in those who might speak out against him. And there's a real there's a real threat that this is going to intensify, because he's not a popular president. If you look at polls, the last one I saw is that, you know, 55% disagreed, 45% agreed. And when you strip out the bases on either side of, like, you know, the MAGA base and then the strong Democratic base, that 10 percentage point gap actually widens. So since he's, you know, not popular, since he's not passing legislation that, you know, fundamentally improves the standard of living for the American public, you know, this is how he goes about it. And this leads into my second point, which is psychological. People who are insecure, people who are bullies, people who are fearful, have defense mechanisms to cope with that. And one way in which they do that is by projecting their own insecurities and fears onto others. So the way I've learned to interpret what Trump says is by, if he says somebody's weaponizing the government against him, what I hear is, I'm going to weaponize the government against this person that poses a threat to my power. So when you see this, the witch hunts, the you know, weaponizing the Department of Justice and the FBI, this is kind of a classic case of, you know, what Sigmund Freud referred to as just coping mechanisms or defense mechanisms when you're paranoid, when you're surrounded by people who are sycophants who always tell you, yes, Donald, you're right. Yes, that's a great idea. Yes, that's a great idea. Nobody's trying to rein him in. And the longer that goes on, the, you know, the more ruthless he will be as the Tony Soprano president, and the more likely he is to continue to weaponize the government in ways that can be, you know, very damaging to the long-term health of these political institutions.
Chris?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that. I mean, that's a lot of what Aaron just described is what's on my mind here. Again, I don't want to get ahead of the facts in this particular case, but I do want to sort of abstract and talk about potential consequences. Let's run the scenario that it turns out there's really nothing. These prosecutors said that the reason why they didn't bring the case. So when you consider that, right, from the citizen standpoint, from us, we the people, where's the check? I mean, where's the accountability? Because, you know, as I was listening to you, Aaron, and you were given a description of Donald Trump, it seems to me I heard a fair amount of people here in New York actually ascribe that same description to Andrew Cuomo during the time he was governor. So there seems to be, from our standpoint as citizens, I mean, what if the government overreaches and really impugns your reputation with an indictment that utterly gets thrown out or defeated in a jury verdict, how do you reestablish the reputation of somebody who was never guilty in the first place? So that's what's on my mind. The founders,
crime,
I mean,
novels.
Yeah. Well, you know, the founders talked about at the Constitutional Convention, they were considering the issue of power and what do we do to keep it in check. And, you know, ultimately they concluded that there's no way you're going to stop humans from being humans. So the best way to do this is have transparency, the sunlight, and then accountability through the separation of powers. And so when you take down those checks and balances and separation of power, when we find executives really overreaching, I mean, until we actually reassess, rebalance our republic, we're going to end up with more situations like that. And that's what's on my mind. I appreciated that description both in terms of the specifics, but also the psychological aspects, because I'm viewing it. I'm concerned about where we are.
David writes to us and says, even if the charges against Comey collapse, which I suspect they will in short order, it costs Comey cash. So Cash Patel and the FBI found new files about Comey, but somehow didn't find the Epstein files. Hopefully the judge will throw it out in short order so they don't gouge Comey for hundreds of thousands of dollars at least. That from Dave.
Yeah, I mean, that's my point. So in those circumstances, shouldn't the citizens be able to recover? Shouldn't they, if they're found, you know
point.
What I'm saying? I mean, there has to be some kind of check against this where individuals can they may not be able to fully recover their reputation, even though they were in some cases unjustifiably impugned, but they should be able to recover their financials.
The plaintiff covers the defendant's legal fees if they're found innocent.
Since it is journalistic law that we must discuss this, here we go. A shutdown is looming. It is a shutdown crisis, as the headlines blare. White House threat of federal layoffs only deepens the shutdown impasse. Democratic leaders said the administration's plan to fire government workers in the event of a shutdown would not prompt them to drop their demands in their spending standoff with the GOP. That from the New York Times. The deadline is Tuesday, October 1st. Aaron Pasitti, one, do you think there will be a shutdown? Two, what should we make of this?
Yeah, I'll take the easy speculative question first. And the answer is I really think that this time around the Democrats aren't going to vote for the spending bill. So I'm going to hedge my bets. I'm 80% certain there'll probably be a shutdown.
Okay. I'm not going to hold you to it or anything.
That's fine. Yeah, but Chris Chris over here, he's talking about accountability. And like, if I make these predictions and I'm wrong, like, where's the accountability?
All right.
I get the angry emails from the readers. So what to make of this? So a government shutdown is what happens when Congress needs to fund legislation to finance previously agreed upon spending from the previous fiscal year. So it's an insane way to govern, and it's has potentially catastrophic could have potentially catastrophic effects on, you know, obviously the functioning of government and providing essential services, but two, on the U.S.'s international standing and the economy as well. So, you know, normally Congress approves a budget and then, you know, they authorize different agencies to spend X amount of dollars. And now we're in a situation where because of the upcoming fiscal year, which starts on October 1st, that additional funding is needed to finance things that Congress already agreed to. So it's a little bit head-scratching. It's a little bit confusing about why our Congress can't get this right. But sadly, shutdowns have become – or the threat of a shutdown has become a way for whatever party is in the minority to bargain for things that they otherwise could not get through the traditional legislative process. So, you know, when Newt Gingrich did it in the 90s with President Clinton, when it happened under President Obama, you've got, you know, Republicans shutting down the voting to shut down the government to get a Democratic president to agree to spending cuts. That seems like you're really holding the whole country and economy hostage to get your preferred political outcomes. So it's not a sane way to govern. It has potentially devastating consequences for, like I said, the economy and society. In terms of what actually happens is that, you know, non-essential workers get furloughed. National defense stays intact, but they don't receive paychecks and then they get back pay. But essential services and employees, senior citizens getting Social Security checks, you know, having hospital visits by Medicare and Medicaid patients paid for, all of those things will continue. But the threat that Democrats see and the reason they didn't shut down or vote for a shutdown in, was it March of this year when it came up last, was that they're afraid that by doing so, it gives the president more power to fire more workers, which is just going to further devastate the functioning of the federal government. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens because Democrats and, you know, I've said this many times because as a panelist on the show, we've covered many shutdowns over the past 10 years or so, and it's not a good way to govern. It doesn't matter whether you've got a Democratic president and a Republican Congress saying we're going to shut down the government unless you slash spending, and I don't think it's a sane way to govern if you've got a Republican president and a Democratic Congress saying we're going to shut down the government if you don't agree to funding for the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. So As far as I know, we're like the only country in the world that uses the shutdown of the government as political leverage. In terms of the consequences of what this could have, and I'll make this short because I know we're on an accelerated timeline. In previous years when the government's been shut down, the mid-90s was a big one with President Clinton, the mid-teens with President Obama, and then the late teens with President Trump. Those shutdowns had a minimal impact on the economy. It doesn't have a substantial effect, but today's economy is much different than the economy of those previous eras where you've got extreme amounts of uncertainty, uncertainty surrounding tariffs, uncertainty surrounding deportations and labor shortages, uncertainty around the size of the federal budget deficit because of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. We're on much more fragile footing. The economy is on much thinner ice than it was in the past. So a prolonged shutdown has the potential to kind of tip an already fragile economy even to further levels of fragility and has the potential to, you know, perhaps push us into a recession because when you lay off and furlough federal employees, that's the direct effect. Then there's the downstream effects of, well, that affects downtown commercial real estate in Washington, D.C., and that affects the people who own the buildings, and that affects defense contractors and the vendors that supply defense contractors. And if it goes on long enough, I think it has the potential to kind of upend an economy that seems to be, as I said before, skating on really thin ice.
Ashley?
Sure. So this hits close to home. Both myself and my husband are public servants. I work in local government, so for Ulster County, but my husband, Dan, he works for Congressman Pat Ryan. So he is a federal employee. When the government shuts down, he no longer gets paid. Of course, there's been a tradition of restoring and back paying him and other employees that this affects. But I also thought it was interesting that yesterday when this threat was being made to the Democrats, that we got reporting that a lot of the DOGE cuts that happened earlier this year were being reversed, that people are being re-offered their jobs, they're being asked to come back. Contracts, rental agreements are also being reversed where those government workers were housed. So is this threat something that's feasible when obviously we need government workers to continue all of these vital programs that are necessary? GIS, there's a hurricane brewing out in the Atlantic Ocean right now. We need people to watch and monitor those weather service and untold many, many departments that this affects. So I think that the Democrats are going to hold firm on this. I think that this will result in a shutdown just because the timing of when people will be in D.C. The Senate's going to come back on Monday. We'll see if Speaker Johnson brings the House back because they're in recess. So this is... of course, anything can happen this weekend, but no one's talking either. There was supposed to be conversations this week that President Trump canceled with Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries. They have made statements. We're ready to talk. We're ready. We're here. I think Chuck Schumer even said, it was kind of funny, we'll meet you on the golf course if that's what it takes. So they need to talk, but Trump is instructing Congress to not talk to their Democratic colleagues. So if we're not going to talk, we're not going to get anywhere. And what the Democrats are leveraging is does hit more than just government employees. It's healthcare, and it's the data is there that this is going to harm millions and millions of Americans with the rollbacks on Medicaid and these Obamacare extensions. And so I think that they politically see that as, of course, so they're going to get blamed. They get blamed for everything. So if you're going to blame the Democrats, at least they can go home and say, we're fighting for your health care, for grandma's health care, mom and dad's health care. That's a valid argument to go back and make to their constituents.
I yield the 2 minutes before the break to the gentleman from Kinderhook. Oh.
Well, I think this is illustrative of the acute dysfunctional moment we're in. You know, Aaron mentioned this is something that we're talking about all the time. And the data show that this specter of government shutdown is largely a modern phenomenon. It's most particularly the prevalence of it. And I see this is related to the previous issue. This is correlated with the imperial presidency. You know, by design, Article 1 provides this responsibility to the people's representatives, and they are by design to work together. As Ashley pointed out, they're not even talking. I mean, this is like dereliction of duty, and what they're most concerned about or most wanting to do is blame the other side. We should not tolerate this, we the people. I mean, this has got to end. It will only end if we rebalance power in this country and the members of Congress reassume their responsibilities for the power of the purse, for the solemn decision on the use of force, even on matters of regulation, which they've largely yielded to the executive branch. All of these things, these major decisions, were meant to be political questions of which the respective leaders dialogue, they debate, they ultimately reach accommodation, and then we're served that way. But we're not served by the disruption that we've been seeing. Aaron pointed out the economic impacts. You know, there are also foreign policy impacts. We look like clowns. So, you know, here's to better days, and it's going to start with us demanding it.
That was Chris Gibson on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 26th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.